Welcome to Imagining the Past, the Summer Autumn Season 2025.
HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to Elders past, present and emerging.
In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from some of the sessions from the HNSA conference held in Sydney on the 21st and 22nd of October 2023. In this session, HNSA Chair and Author Elizabeth Storrs is in conversation with Mirandi Rewo and Vivica Pon Nambalam. And a reminder, these are live recordings, so there are a few lamentable glitches.
Mirandi and Vivica have written extraordinary books. And one thing that I've discovered is that there's an intersection between them because they give a different perspective to the colonial experience. We in Australia tend to only look at it from the British colonial rule. But Mirandi's book is set in Indonesia, which at the time was the Dutch East Indies and wasn't Indonesia till 1949, I understand. And Favika is set in Polynesia, Tahiti, which is the French colonial. So we're going to explore a little bit of that perspective. But the books are all also very much about identity. And we're going to look at the characters involved. There are quite a few characters, and there are various points of view. So let's start, though, with Mirandi talking about what her book is about, what her inspiration was, and then we're going to have a short reading.
Oh, okay.
And I've chosen the read.
Oh, I've got a thing.
Yeah.
I've got a thing so I can use my hand. So I was at my cousin's place one day and she introduced me to this man whose father was a baby when he was rushed out of Java when the Japanese were invading. And his father was a pilot, like a KLM pilot, but the local Air Force was, planes were KNILM. So it was a sort of form of KLM that came to Australia and back to Indonesia. Which I think is kind of interesting anyway, that they had this airline just for between Australia and Indonesia as well at the time when it was Dutch East Indies. Anyway, so what happened is those pilots were, when the Japanese came in, they were absorbed into the Allied forces. The Allied forces wanted them because, of course, they couldn't go back to Holland. Holland had been taken over by the Germans. Anyway, so these pilots apparently said, yes, but you've got to get our families out. And eventually they were given something like half an hour's notice to get their families out of the country via Broome into Australia. So, and as soon as he was talking, I'd had one of my writers' groups and we talked about, well, you know, what do people want to read? If it's historical, maybe wartime, maybe a bit of romance. So when I was hearing about this Dutch pilot and, you know, wartime, I was like, tell me more. So I went away and did my research. I knew almost immediately, I'd say almost immediately, I knew there would be a Dutch pilot with some tough decisions to make. So I would have known very quickly what the trajectory of the book was going to look like, and that was sort of filled in time. So then it's about this Dutch pilot. He's marrying into a Dutch Eurasian family in Dutch East Indies, so they own a wealthy tea plantation. And the other point of view is the Indonesian housekeeper. So she's actually native Indonesian and from her point of view. So we're looking at the final months before the Japanese invade. Yes.
Tell us a little bit about Anna.
Okay, so the three or four main characters are there's Matthias, who's the Dutch pilot. There's Anna. Her father's Dutch and her mother's also Eurasian. So her mother's of Chinese, Indonesian, Dutch background. So what happens in Indonesia if you were Eurasian, they were called Indo. If you were Indo and your Dutch father accepted you, you were Dutch. Otherwise, you were illegitimate and you were considered something like a village Indo, which was not a great thing to be because you weren't then Indonesian or Dutch. So she's sort of in that precarious, and I was interested in writing a Eurasian character, obviously, because I'm Eurasian. My father's Indonesian Chinese. So Anna is Eurasian, and then there's Dia, who is the Indonesian housekeeper. She's native Indonesian, and she's looking at everything. Would you like me to read? Okay. So in this part, they're talking about it's Sigit. He's Dia, the housekeeper, who's Indonesian. Her brother is a nationalist freedom fighter. So they actually were looking forward to the Japanese invading because the Japanese had promised them freedom from the Dutch. And they're talking about Serawangi is the name of the tea plantation. So this is Anna, the Eurasian girl, and Sigit talking. He reaches over, slides on off the lid. So they're looking in a tin. The tin is crammed with folded documents and newspaper clippings. A few photos rest on top of the pile and she says, "May I?" and brings them out when he nods. Holding the first one up to what light ekes its way through the doorway, she can just make out a grey blur of bushes blanketed across the plains. Forests felled near the Banten Promise to make way for the coffee plantations, Sigit murmurs. She frowns over the next two photographs. The first is an image of helmeted Dutch soldiers advancing over a ridge, the grass wavering about their knees, a puff of white smoke beyond. The second is of more soldiers, too many to count, staring into the camera with rifles resting over their arms, clustered about their hunting trophies. Several of the men rest their feet on lifeless rumps or stand directly on top of their heaped prey. Peering closer, she makes out prostrate limbs, a tangle of arms, the side of a face. Man or woman, she cannot tell. Of villages, the men have massacred. She can't bring herself to look at Sigit when he says, "Ache." The last photograph is one that she is familiar with, for its twin is mounted on the wall at Serawangi. Two young men sporting luxuriant moustaches and safari hats stand by an irrigation ditch. The tea shrubs are young, still hopeful seedlings cresting at Serawangi's dark earth. "That's my grandfather and his brother," she says, looking up at Sigit, puzzled. He leans across and points at a figure beyond the ditch. The man is stooped over a plant, a blancong, wrapped about the crown of his head. Smooth back, strong calves. "And that's my grandfather." "Oh, he worked at Serawangi?" "Our families always worked the land." He smiles at her as he lights a cigarette, lets the meaning of his words sink in. Heat rises to her cheeks. "I suppose you mean that we have interloped, that my father should somehow give over our tea plantation?" "Give it back, you mean?" "My father employs many people. The plantation supports your family and many more." "Yeah, on their own land. Pappy's very good to them, but he's not their pappy." She picks up a cup, which is empty. The rain continues to patter outside, the damp mingling with the clove fragrance of his cigarette. "Perhaps we should read while we wait," she says, taking Kartini's book from her basket. And those photographs are true. Yeah.
So I will come back to this. It's a very powerful image. And I think that's kind of, in a nutshell for me, one of the threads of the story about identity, colonialism, paternalism, and also just perspective. Perspective, you know. Okay, Thevika. Thevika's book is an amazing imagining of Paul Gauguin's half-wife muse. She was 13, Polynesian. And it's also has many viewpoints, but one of them is from Aline Gauguin's same age daughter back in Denmark, who is allowed to have a normal childhood. So, Thevika, thanks very much. Could you talk about your book, what inspired you, and then we will go to your reading.
Yeah. I saw the painting which the book revolves around. I saw an image, a very small kind of reproduction of it within a magazine article that was about Gauguin. So sort of now it was 20 years ago. And that really kind of sparked my interest about the story. Everyone knew about Gauguin. I had sort of a vague idea about his journey. But it was really that painting, the girl in that painting, which is the main character, Te Amana, struck a chord in me. It just kind of, her image, that image of her looking out towards the viewer. She's naked in the painting. It's a very kind of, it's a vulnerable pose, but there's also something very powerful about it. So yeah, it struck a chord within me. I read some things, you know, about him and his journey within the article about how he went to Tahiti and, you know, gave up his family and went to search for the true meaning in his art, really. So that you know, but the whole kind of story about the girl was missing. And then when I dug deeper later on, the image stayed with me. But then, and when I went to do my creative writing MA, I was searching for a story to write, and that image just kind of came back into my mind. It was always there, and I started digging a bit deeper into the girl, and also the girls. I mean, Gauguin, she wasn't his first muse. He had a number of muses in Tahiti, and there was really nothing there in the public domain, nothing at all. So that really spurred me on to try and find out more, to try and tell her story, really. There were so many questions that were unanswered then, and even in the years that followed, and the more research I did, there was just like a missing piece in the puzzle for me. So that's where the journey began. And you know, when I sort of found out a bit more about his family as well, I realized that he had one daughter with his Danish wife, and she was approximately the same age as Te Amana. So there was that link there that I couldn't really not explore as well. So I started out writing Te Amana's story in conjunction with Aline's story. And it always began with these sort of diary entries. It felt just very natural then. And over the years, when I explored all the different ways of telling Te Amana's story primarily, I dropped Aline's voice, but then it came back again much later when I was putting the book together.
And could you read that passage?
Yeah. So this is one of Aline's entries. Dear Diary, this morning I was lying in bed when I heard the sound of a carriage coming to a halt in the street below and our family name being called out. I threw off my covers and rushed to the window to see two hefty Danes easing down a large parcel from the roof rack. One of them disappeared inside with it. Still in my nightdress, I ran down the stairs two at a time and almost fell headlong into the package, which was wrapped in sackcloth and secured with rope. I knew immediately it was from Papa, all the way from Tahiti. It was addressed to Maman, the large, thick lettering drawn in black paint. Maman pushed me aside with irritation and told the man to position it against the far wall, then reluctantly gave him 50 kroner, as is the custom here. When he was gone, she told P to fetch a knife with which to cut the rope, but he ignored her request, so I ran to the kitchen to fetch one myself. What a sight it is to behold. Maman calls it disgusting, but Papa claims it is his best work yet. He says it will rival Manet's very own Olympia, and proclaims the girl in the painting, a savage Eve, a black Venus who belongs to a paradise lost. The painting is of a native lying on her front, her face turned to the viewer, a cloaked figure crouching at the foot of the bed. Papa calls it the spirit of the dead keeps watch, and gave an explanation in his letter to Maman. So everyone will know the story behind the picture and what to say to the critics when the time comes. He wants Maman to take it to Paris, where it will be the star of the show upon his return. In his description, Papa explains she is terrified of the dark, this girl, and that all the people on the island sleep with a lamp burning beside the door in order to keep out the ghosts. They call them to Papa, the spirits of the dead, and the title of the painting, in their language, is Mano to Papa. This is what Papa will call it. The translation is merely for our benefit. I copied it into the palm of my hand so I could transfer it freely into my diary. A whole sentence condensed in two words. What a strange and marvelous thing. Apparently the girl entered his hut and took off her dress, as one discards rotten fruit. It is why she is naked. How could she be so fearless and free? And that is Maman's pillowcase she rests her head upon, the edges of which are embroidered with rosebuds and their tiny leaves. Papa says he has put a streak of fear in the girl's eyes. She lies belly down, the palms of her hands pressed firmly on the pillow, as though waiting for something or someone.
Thanks, Predica. If you get a chance to Google that, and when I Googled it, it was shocking because all my life I have looked at Gauguin's paintings, and it was these beautiful, serene Polynesian women with a bloom behind one ear. And this painting is visceral, especially once you've read this book, because it conjures up the mythology that is behind the Polynesian origin stories and their superstitions. It links Tamana to Aline, because Aline is so affected by this painting that is brought into their house. So there's a lot to unpack in your books, but I'd like to look at why you called it I Am Not Your Eve, because you talk about, Gauguin talks about his mother, who was half, he says, Inca, half Indian, as his first true Eve. He talks about his daughter, who sees in her eyes resemblance of a mother. And then you have Tamana herself. To talk a little bit why you called it that. Theme.
It just felt very natural to me, because the whole book is about him searching for this paradise lost and, you know, looking for the lost Eve, you know. He was always looking for that, or he was always looking for this untouched world. And that's why he left Paris and went to Brittany, you know, and then sort of he went to Martinique as well. That was another period of his life. He was always sort of traveling and looking for a place that was, just not touched by civilization, just going back to the beginning, really. And it felt natural to me that she was speaking back, that because I was trying always to find her voice. And she was his first Eve on Tahiti. And it's her speaking back, her saying, well, you know, I'm not yours. I'm not your Eve. I'm not this person you imagined I was. I'm not that girl in the painting. I have a voice. It just seemed really straightforward to me. And I also, someone once sort of said, you know, to me, she was Gauguin's Eve, or these were his Eves. And I thought about that, you know, for a long time. And I thought, well, she's not, you know, it would have been very easy to call it Gauguin's Eve, the book, you know, or Gauguin's Lover, which was an early title. I didn't want to bring his name into it. Everybody knows his story. And that's another thing that I've done in the book, is that, you know, I've not given him a name in the book, but obviously in the blurb it says, you know, his name is spelt out. So that was quite hard as well, just to give him not to give him a name because she never had a name ever in the paintings. Well, she didn't. One of his paintings names her, but yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
So Mirandi, coming back to identity, with that passage, I actually was most engaged with Anna and Sigit because there's an expression you use that she felt unmoored, and it was in relation to another scene, but I just thought that this kind of summed up her mental state. We've got the Japanese are about to invade. You've had the Dutch East Indies. She's an Indo, but she's claimed by her father, so therefore she's Dutch. She's never been to Holland, so she has this concept of herself as being Dutch, and then suddenly her eyes are opened. Sigit has been educated in Holland. He's come back. He's a resistance fighter, and there's that scene where suddenly she's looking at a photo that's she knows that's my grandfather, and then he points to a shadowy figure, and it's just like a whole new perspective comes
for her.
Right. So can you talk a little bit about?
Yeah, I guess for Anna, what's happened is she is brought up Dutch, and what happened is the Dutch women, young women, then would have gone to Europe and done, you know, the finishing school kind of things, like, and then ended up in Holland. So, you know, I read about it from, you know, a memoir about this woman. What you would do is you'd go to like Paris and, you know, all places in Europe, end up in Holland, do a bit of finishing school, you know, meet men, hopefully get married well, that sort of thing. And of course, all this falls apart for her because of World War II and the Japanese invading. So I guess for her, and time speeds up a little because the Japanese are about to invade and she doesn't know what's going to happen. So she's, and all the Dutchmen are taken off to fight, you know, to get prepared to fight the Japanese. So there's no more parties. There's no more sort of the things that they used to do at the clubs and dances and that sort of thing. So she starts to explore, I guess, her Indonesian side. And she's stuck at home anyway at the plantation. And I feel for Anna, these things that she starts to feel and do, she wouldn't have if say the Japanese weren't on the way, she would have just gone on with her social life as a well-off Dutch girl. So she's sort of, yeah, turned a corner because of what's happening. And I guess when I was writing it, I had it was in the middle of COVID. So what I really tried to represent was that the not knowing, you know, like what we had in COVID, which I've never had in my lifetime with, say, wartime, is the not knowing, like, where are the borders shut? Where can I go? Is there still time to get out? You know, which we were all kind of facing in a way with COVID, like, you know, with the rules changing. And so I wanted that sort of uncertainty. She wasn't sure. Like, and even I was thinking later, like, I wanted to show, like, they had a, you know, their English business friends had to flee from Malaysia and they went to Singapore. But of course, in hindsight, we know Singapore was worse than Malaysia, that they weren't to know. So, you know, you're making sort of mistakes as well that we know now. And of course, and then that idea of having to leave everything behind, because of course, when I was writing it, to Ukraine happened, you know, that idea of like, what do you take? What do you have to leave behind? And just how difficult that is. You know, so, and I did want to look at, I wanted the book to be, you know, when you read about the Dutch East Indies, you get all these different impressions. You've either got the Indonesians who, you know, feel very well rid of the Dutch, you know, and were resistant at the time and did get a lot of their education in Holland about independence and, you know, liberalism and stuff. And then there was the Eurasians who had this idyllic life there, like idyllic. Of course, they look back on it like fondly. And the Dutch people, of course, like who reaped lots of rewards from their time there. So I wanted to kind of see it from all those different facets, not just, you know, good and bad or anything, but, you know, just how these people personally from different. And then Dia, who's the servant, see, she's grown up with them. These Eurasian families, these kids would grow up in the family as well. So she has loyalties as well to these people. And meanwhile, her brother's like fighting against them. So I just wanted to show all these sort of difficulties and different facets to that sort of colonial life, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's a real tapestry. It's, you're weaving, it's very expert. You're weaving all of these different characters together. The sense I get with Dia, who's the housemaid, but she herself educates. She's kind of an autodidact. She reads novels.
Yes, so I took some liberties there. She grew up with the family, so she started out with as like a very young sort of nanny to Anna, but she's only like a few years older than Anna. And that was another thing, you know, that still happens in Indonesia, that young women have to leave their own families to go look after other families, things. Well, that happens worldwide too. But I did read a lot of the older Eurasian families were quite inclusive with their servants as well. So I did take the liberty of having her sort of grow up in the schoolroom at the same time. So she has a bit of, they've been good to her and her brother. And it did happen. Her brother, they sent to Holland for an education. And those sort of, you know, things did happen. Anyway, so that's, so she does have an eye on what's happening.
Yeah.
But also has loyalties.
Yes.
So
in terms of, I kind of saw that as a passivity, with a passivity. And then we come to Vivica's book and we see Tahiti, where the Christian missionaries are involved there. And Vivica is raised by two mothers, a foster mother and her birth mother. And there's a sense that I felt like there was a sense of real passivity about their acceptance of the colonial life. And also I almost felt like those mothers were grooming her, because they were saying, yes, go with the painter. You know, you've got an opportunity here. You have her, he has her painted with the white and blue striped dress that, it's kind of a civilizing factor instead of the nude figure. So what's your view about how the Polynesians viewed colonialism at that time, and particularly the women?
Yeah.
I mean, I think, well, at that time it was seen as a kind of a badge of honor. It was a thing, it was a sign of prestige to go with a white man because of the economic benefits, the fact that the girl would, live in a better way and gain knowledge. It was seen, to go and mix with another culture was seen as something that would benefit their own culture. I think that was really what was happening at the time. And there wasn't really... The kind of the gap as well, there was a gap, moral gap in how we see things now. It was different. It was different then. And the culture was different in Tahiti. So the girls were a lot older, a lot younger, started from the age of 12, you know, the girls were routinely getting married. And they weren't actually getting married. They were going and living with men and trying and seeing if that's what they wanted, if things would work out, and they had the freedom to go and come back. So that was very different as well. So we have to kind of look at it from a different angle, a different point of view, because the way we see that things now is like we have these different moral standards. So, so there were a lot of things to kind of get my head around and figure out and feel, you know, is this right? Is this wrong? Is this how people, you know, how people see it now? Isn't right, you know, it's wrong. And to kind of get through that and think about it in a different way. And that was for me always the challenge, like from the beginning.
I'll just continue with you, Sophie, for a moment. There is a strong feminine presence throughout this book. There's the Temano self, Aline. There's Gauguin's wife, who is very hard put upon. But there's also the origin stories. There's the Hina, the moon goddess. There is a strong feminine presence. But what I noticed, though, was that Temano didn't have a father. I didn't sense that she saw Gauguin as a father figure. And I was just wondering, you know, why was that absence there?
I was drawn to her relationships with her mothers. I mean, that was actually a fact that you know, she was brought up by a foster mother. That was part of the culture. You were brought up with, not within one family, but it was like a whole community. So I wanted to explore that, those relationships and what might have happened. There was kind of, all that information was really missing in my research. Well, not, there was nothing there. So I wanted to explore what might have happened between the mother, why the mother might have given her to, you know, her cousin's sister, and the father. Yeah, it was just something that just came naturally, I think, in that story. I just explored that father was there in the beginning, you know, when she was born. And he's there, kind of, he's there in the background. But it was really the strong female presence that kind of drew all the various stories on. And the fact is, I didn't really want to explore the idea of this, of Te'amana thinking of Gauguin as a father figure. That was something that's explored in Aline's relationship with her father, you know, that this very overpowering relationship, the way she puts her father on a pedestal. So with Te'amana, it was more a sense of, through Gauguin, she was exploring her identity in the world, her identity in two worlds, two different cultures. She doesn't know she's doing that, but in the book, throughout the book, she's kind of, she is caught between two worlds, the old world and the new, the one that's actually hidden, the ancient world that's been destroyed, but was destroyed before she was born, really. So for me, there's just so much, and I had to decide to keep it sort of simple. There's just so many relationships to explore, and in that sense, I suppose that's why I didn't go down the road of exploring her relationship with her father, because there was this other father daughter relationship going on with Aline.
Thanks. Whereas in your book, the father is very much a character. The legitimacy claiming her as his daughter gives her privilege and a great life. And then you have this other story, this novel within a novel about Finja de Vries.
Yes.
Can you tell me why you introduced that character?
Okay, so it's kind of, yes, so Fincher de Vries, as I did a library talk at State Library of New South Wales, and a Dutch woman came up to me later and she said, why do you use these Dutch names if you cannot pronounce them? I was like, well, that's going to be my next writer's tip, is always choose names you can pronounce. Anyway, Fincher de Vries is, so when I did my research, I also researched how these Indo women were looked at, these Eurasian women were looked at in Indonesia at the time. And I came across a Dutch academic who wrote about Indo women, but she wrote in one of her papers was specifically on this woman named Fincher de Phoenix, who was in the 1920s. She was murdered by another Indo man, but he was identified as Dutch. And it was about the court case, but she was a sex worker. So it was what her paper was on was showing all the different ways this woman was represented, like in the newspapers as, you know, this sort of wanton, you know, the sort of village
Village Indo. Obviously, in the court case, they, you know, other sex workers came forward to say they saw him murdering her, and they were told they were liars. They were told, you're not allowed to lie in court, things like that. And then a Chinese writer wrote it sort of as nonfiction, but like as fiction. He wrote a story about her life, which was more sympathetic. And she was just showing all these different ways of looking at this woman's life, some more sympathetic than others, in a very sort of colonial way. And then I thought, well, that'd be interesting for Anna, who's Eurasian as well, to maybe be watching this sort of murder play out in the newspapers. And she's looking at it from a sort of more subjective way, you know, like her father and brother are like, he belonged to our club. I mean, he's fine. Why would he marry a sex worker? Which is so, why would he marry? Why would he murder a sex worker? Which is true. You know, how people sort of legitimize these sort of things. And, you know, he's a great man. Why would he do this sort of thing versus the horror? So the original Chinese story was, you know, in that very sort of flowery sort of way of, the, you know, that they would have, you know, wrote in the 1920s. And it was sort of like this tragic story that happened in Batavia. It was Jakarta. So I made mine in Bandung, the tragic story of, you know, feature de Vries in Bandung. And I guess like with The Fish Girl or Anna the Javanese, I tried to show it from her point of view, like how her trajectory up to the point that she's murdered and why. And so I guess what I wanted the reader to wonder who's writing that version, I guess, for one thing. And also it's juxtaposing the newspapers and what the courts are saying, what other white men are saying in real time. And also I think because, you know, there's a lot of talk about giving, I know when I wrote The Fish Girl, you know, like people say, oh, you're giving these people a voice, which is what I think is actually you're giving another version. Because I was reading this review of a book about Sylvia Plath, about all the biographies that have been written about Sylvia Plath, and that actually none of them are really probably fair to her, because they're giving her maybe ideas and actions that she didn't do or didn't, you know. So in a way, even if they're sympathetic, it's still like maybe not fair. And I feel like they're all just versions. Whatever we're writing are just versions. So I did want to kind of touch on that as well. But even my, you know, Fish Girl, my Anna the Javanese, her, they're all like versions too. And who are writing them? You know, where are we hearing these things from? So yeah.
Fevika, you have a lot of different points of view in your. And what one of the things that really interested me is that there was another work of art that was of her, which was a statuette. And you have the statuette's point of view looking upon her as well as Tamana herself. And I was wondering, why did you bother? Why did you have the external view of the statuette looking at her and then her internal thoughts? I was just interested why you chose that device.
That's the wooden mask.
Yes.
There were a couple of pieces that he did of her that were always going to be within the book. I didn't know I was going to do it until I was kind of in the, you know, it was much later on in the book. I think it's a way of expressing Tamana's inner thoughts by moving outside of the eye. And I think it's like she's looking at herself. And that's why I kind of step outside of her voice and for example, go to the lizard, you know, in the hut that becomes a character. It's because it's another perspective on what's going on, which is just at times so difficult for me. It was so difficult at points to kind of tell her story. So that's why I kind of jump around and then come back again, because it gives me kind of, you know, a bit of a breathing space away from just being inside her. Because she's in that hut and she's being painted for a really long time, you know, for long periods of time. And I wanted to step outside of that and give, yeah, just give another kind of perspective and then go back again. I think that it was, for me, it was very freeing. And I just also wanted to kind of pick up on what Mirandi said, which about the voice. I think that's such a brilliant thing that you said, because that's so true. Because, you know, people keep on saying, you know, you're giving her a voice, and you kind of get caught up in that, because it's not really, you're not really giving her a voice. You're, for this moment in time, you're giving her a voice, but then, you know, she has so many different voices depending on who decides to write that story, because that story is particular to me, because there's you know, a lot of you in there when you write that story. When someone else attempts to write that story, it will be very, very different. You know, it might not be this multiple perspective as well, because that's the way I approached it. Somebody else might approach it differently. So it's really open to interpretation. My interpretation became, this polyphonic, you know, they call it, it's a polyphonic narrative, which might not be for everyone's taste, you know, because there is a lot, it is quite complex, because at times you're wondering who's speaking. But hopefully it's really clear at the end of the day, you're always with Teamana. Whatever happens, you know, you go back to her, even though you're with someone else. That person is still telling her story.
I have to say, I did read it twice because there were a lot of voices. It was worth reading twice because there was a lot to take in, and it was. It was beautifully written, as both books were beautifully written. I have run out of time, and I have to be a big hypocrite if I don't move to question time. So thank you, Chris. Could you go online first?
Well, no. Show you
now. I'm professional.
So. The first virtual question is from Andy, and he asks what both of your main sources and tools of research are for both historical and cultural information.
Okay. So I was thinking lately, I was in COVID. What I usually like to do is, like, say, for Stone Skies, I like to... So it'll usually take like a year or two, the research, at least before I'll even start writing anything. I'll be sort of taking notes to do the story. I'm looking at you like I'm answering your question. But so there's lots of, like, obviously book and internet research and everything. And then I know Lauren talks about this, how great it is to go to the place, you know, and really see it as your character would see it. I think that's really important. For this book, unfortunately, it was COVID time. So I procrastinated heaps. So, you know, I did a lot of the reading stuff, but I was sort of like, oh, what am I, you know, like, I just had to eventually go, look, you're just going to have to write what you can. And eventually I did get there a year or two before it came out. And some of it, for me, I know exactly where I was, like, writing that book when I was there. What I found particularly rich for this novel, which I only realized lately, was the memoirs from Indo women, so Eurasian women who wrote really fondly and in a lot of detail about their lives before they were all chucked out of Indonesia. And it also only occurred to me lately that that we wouldn't have these rich memoirs at all if they weren't thrown out of Indonesia. Like, those women would still be just living their lives there. And getting on with things, and they wouldn't have had this sort of impetus to write down everything they could remember from that time. So that was really rich for my book. Talking about cultural, I guess, considerations, in the end, well, like I said, my dad's Indonesian Chinese anyway. My stepmom is native Indonesian. And so I could text them anytime, and I've grown up, you know, in an Indonesian family. But also I did have an Indonesian academic
fiction writer, have a look at it too before I sort of moved on, the whole thing, especially with Dia, the housekeeper part. So, yeah, so it's just an all-rounder. Sorry, Tamika, I took up a lot of time.
No, that's fine. I took years. I procrastinated because I felt like it was just so huge, you know, all the history. But I did loads of research at the British Library. I was really lucky that I was living in London then. And I had access to all these historical kind of tomes, which were mainly missionary accounts. I did find them really dry and a lot of it unengaging, but I read a lot of it just to kind of understand the historical aspect of what happened when, you know, the British first colonized Tahiti, British, and then it was the French. There was a Spanish as well. French, yeah, in between, yeah. It was a really complicated history, and I was trying. I tried for a long time to kind of get an idea, a timeline down, but I always knew I wasn't going to write that kind of book. The thing that really jumped out at me was all the myths and legends. I read so many books on all the legends, really the myths and legends that underpinned society, the Polynesian society, and I just made loads and loads of notes over the years. And certain stories stuck with me. But I was just really fearful of going there because I couldn't, it was such a long journey as well, getting there. And at the time, you know, I couldn't really afford to do that. So that was another thing that held me back. There was a lot of fear. But in the end, I did go there. Sort of, you know, much, much later towards the end. I still hadn't written the book. So it was really going to Tahiti, pulled it all together. Going there, and I spoke to a lot of people. They were really, everyone that I spoke to was really open, but no one knew anything about her and what had happened to her. So I spoke to academics, historians, you know, people just people that have been living there all their lives and, understanding more about the culture and the landscape was really vital for me. And all the research that I did kind of all came together there. There were a lot of missing links that I knew that I'd never solve, even going there. So I had to come back and make my own decisions. And I did more research on myths and legends when I was there with the Tahitian guides that helped me. So It was a long, complicated journey.
Mm-hmm. Is there any questions around the room?
We have one and we have asks. Hey guys.
Another one online. One. Okay. Bethany, who can always be relied upon to ask questions, says, given Mirandi has also written about Gauguin and his exploited young muses in Anna the Javanese, I'd love to hear both of the guests discuss, very briefly please, the similarities and differences in each other's interpretation or approach and why they chose him.
Oh my God, that's really interesting because everything Tamika was saying, I was just like, oh my God, this is like mine. In mine she's referred to as Tahura. And I use that same painting, but in a way that an art critic has written their thesis on that painting, comparing it to the Manet, I think, a Manet, and that it's, you know, he's turned the black figure into death and blah, blah, blah. And I've got my Anna thinking about that. But it's just amazing, the intersections between our stories. It's amazing. I just love it. But also in that whole, like, how you were saying you won't name him in yours. So in mine, I've got her, she calls him Pol, P-O-L, like she can't pronounce his name properly. But that was also, like you said, like it was also like on purpose to kind of not name him. Yeah. So, there were so many intersections. It was awesome.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's amazing that, it's just amazing that you wrote that about that particular painting, well, inspired by that painting. Because I have that image, you know, in the back of my head. That's such a powerful image, Anna. And even just the stance, you know, the way she sits there, it's very confronting.
I mean, she was supposed to be only 13 as well. But I did always wonder if that was, she was confused with Tahura. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but also it's a very powerful position, the way she takes, but you know, the way he puts her in that chair, and it's very powerful, even though it's very disturbing. And yeah, it's interesting about the names, Tahura, and I had that as well. The fact she's called Tahura in many different places, and you know, I had to just dig deeper to find out, trying to decide really what her real name was, actually. He used Tahura to, you know, in a kind of fictional sense.
Yeah, and he was so performative. It was, yeah.
Well, he wrote his own story, you know. Mm. He disguised the truth, wrote his own story. So we have to unpack that.
I could talk about these two books for a long time, but unfortunately we can't. So would you all please thank Levika and Randy?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I always do it here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, held from the 2023 HNSA conference held in Sydney. Just a reminder that 2025 is conference year and details will soon be announced. Visit our website, hnsa.org.au, join our Facebook group and subscribe to our newsletter to be up to date. And please explore our podcast archive, treasure trove of historical ideas. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.